Hi.
New York, New York. 10036. Pro country.
What you see is what you get.
Hell has no fury. He drives the most expensive car because second best never enters his mind.
Of all the billions of planets in space, only one is off limits to man.
It all began with a curse.
The evil you did this day will be avenged.
A curse.
From the mists of infinity, they come, rising from the cold, damp earth to take what is now theirs.
You are in a room filled with your friends, but they are all dead.
Night, when the earth is quiet, and the good people of the world are sleeping, the night visitor comes to call.
The streets have been taken over by thieves, dope addicts, rapists, muggers. We live in fear. One man is doing something about it.
These are the sounds of 6 feet of silver death.
Grindhouse Purgatory, 42nd Street, Pete.
From the Grindhouse Purgatory magazine, 42nd Street Pete has seen it all, literally and figuratively. And 42nd Street Pete is here to give you his remembrances of the Grindhouse era in 42nd Street Pete's Grindhouse Purgatory. Pete?
Yes, we are sitting in Purgatory, which is slightly warmer than hell, I think. But, yes, I'm glad we had an opportunity to do this to see if anybody's really still interested in all this stuff. So I understand you have some pertinent questions up your sleeve, so by all means, ask.
Okay, I guess my first question for you would be, now, I just missed the Grindhouse era. I mean, I was still I was alive when it happened, but I was like 5 years old, so I did not personally experience the Grindhouse era, and I think a lot of people listening to this probably didn't either. Describe to them what the Grindhouse truly was versus the Robert Rodriguez, Quentin Tarantino version of what the Grindhouse era was.
Well, you got to figure where I lived, which was basically New York, New Jersey area, the East Coast. Mainly in New York, but like if you spread out into like I said, certain parts of New Jersey, there were these very old, once opulent theaters that fell into states of disrepair. Now, the ones on 42nd Street were actually akin to the Broadway ones. And after the Depression, I believe it was the Brandt chain that bought them all up and, you know, were running, you know, movies in them again. At the time, they were probably, you know, first-run family movies. But as things progressed, as we got into, I'd say the pivotal time would start to be the mid-60s when things turned around. Like you had stuff like Blood Feast and the Flesh Eaters and some really extreme horror movies. And then right after that, you know, you hit 64, 65, the spaghetti westerns came in, and then the biker films and the women in prison. Then you know, you oozed into the 70s with, you know, the Nazi exploitation, black exploitation, et cetera, et cetera. So you had all this stuff progress over a period of time. And these theaters were basically indestructible. I mean, like I said, there were once, you know, magnificent looking places. Some had etched glass on their doors and things. Huge lobbies that would be filled with garish standees and lobby cards and one sheets of all this horrible, nasty shit you were going to go see. So that's the true Grindhouse. And they believe, you know, everybody has their own idea. Well, I was fortunate enough to become friends with the late Colonel David Friedman. And his thing was, you know, these were places they ground out films 24/7, or maybe it seemed like 24/7. But there was never any like, okay, we're shutting down between films. They just kept going on and on and on and on, one right after another. So it was grinding them out. And then, you know, especially like the porn grinders, there was a couple, the harem on 42nd Street was open 24/7. All the other ones were open till about 7 o'clock in the morning. Then they would close and reopen at 10 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, that was the whole Grindhouse scene. You know, these seedy, decrepit theaters that, you know, ran some really cool fucking movies.
The 42nd Street Forever DVD sets, they have commentaries on the later ones. And they talk about how especially in the really hot summers in the 70s and whatnot, where people couldn't afford air conditioning. These places were air conditioned, and people would come in regardless of what the movie was, just to pay, you know, 75 cents, a dollar or whatever, for 2 hours of air conditioning. And, oh, hey, Cannibal Holocaust is playing too.
Yeah, well, you know, once you pay, they never kick you out. I mean, most of the places, you know, I'm thinking going back, when did I start going over there? I started going over there in like 68, 69. It was like 75 cents a dollar, you know, during the day. Then it went up to $1.50. But then after five, it was like $3. So, yeah, you pretty much, you know, and like places like the Venus, they, you know, toward the end, they call it the Hobo Hilton because homeless guys used to crash there. For $3, it was a crash pad.
And see, so, the 1989 movie Shakedown by James Glickenhaus actually uses that as a plot point. Sam Elliott's police character doesn't have an apartment. His listed street address is a grindhouse theater, ironically enough, showing James Glickenhaus movies, where he just pays every day the rent of $7, and then he just goes and sleeps in a stand and then washes up in the bathroom. Is that James Glickenhaus taking creative license, or is that really what it was like?
No, it's not too far-fetched. I mean, I'm sure, you know, people were sleeping in there. You know, when I was a kid growing up, it was winos and bums. You know, I used to go to this place called the Embassy Theater in Orange, which was another big grindhouse. But, you know, these guys would, you know, come in mid-afternoon because even though there was really no audience, I think it was a union type thing with the projectionist where they were obligated to run the film during the day for a matinee showing, no matter if nobody showed up. So these guys would go in there with their pint or whatever and crash in the back. So no, it isn't far-fetched at all. It happened.
Well, what about the old raincoat crowd stereotype that the grindhouses had, especially the porno ones like the Venus and whatnot, where you'd have the guys, you know, wearing just a raincoat, beaten off in the seats and the sticky floors, not from soda residue and whatnot. Is that a founded one, or is that one got a grain of truth in it?
It may have. I never whacked off in a movie theater, to be perfectly honest with you. There's nothing more helpless than a man with his pants down around his ankles anyway. So why would you want to do that? But I guess some people just did it. I never saw the whole, you know, I know guys whacked off in pee booths and shit like that. I just never saw the whole rubbing one out in public thing, unless, you know, your home life was such under such close scrutiny that you couldn't rub one out at home, you know?
Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was guys, you know, habitual, you know, these guys used to just jerk off in these movie theaters and shit, and the burlesque houses, things like that. You know, you didn't want to sit too close to anybody, you know?
Pee-wee Herman.
Yeah.
He got caught stroking it. I don't remember what movie he was stroking it to, though, off the top of my head.
Yeah, well, you know, only two guys in the history of Western civilization to get shot in the back of the head in the movie theater: Abraham Lincoln and the guy sitting in front of Pee-wee Herman.
Da-dum!
Yep. So, yeah.
Well,
it was all kinds of weird shit that went on, especially in the porn joints, because, you know, you'd have low rent, you know, hookers prowling the audience offering to give head for $5 while they deftly lifted your wallet, you know? So
that's the other thing I was going to bring up. I was going to say the grindhouses have a reputation of being, you used the term seedy, and I don't think that's the wrong term, but of being just bastions of crime and prostitution and drugs and is that founded?
Not that much. I mean, you know, there were certain places like, you know, the Anco Theater, which was on the corner of 42nd and 8th. That place was really run down. You get ripped off going in there. If these places allowed that shit to happen constantly, they wouldn't have any patrons. So some of them were patrolled, some of them weren't. You know, the old trick with the junkies were, to go in the bathrooms and like unscrew the light bulbs so they can mug you. So there was certain rules you learned by going to these grindhouses. I mean, like I said, the porn ones as opposed to like the regular ones, there was a big difference because you wouldn't have that element that much hanging in the bigger ones. Plus, some of those places actually had visible security. So, but you know, the porn ones, who the fuck knew? You know, that's why everybody always said, you know, there's a distinctive odor in a grindhouse of like tobacco, cigar smoke, pot smoke, you know, beer, spilled wine, and piss. Well, a lot of people used to just piss in popcorn cups and just dump it on the floor rather than get up to go to the fucking can for fear of getting mugged or ripped off. All kinds of weird shit went down.
Well, now, that said, certain types of movies are known as grindhouse movies from that era.
Right.
You know, something like Cannibal Holocaust and New York Ripper and all that, that was probably – that was never going to play in a mainstream movie theater and probably didn't have a big drive-in life. But did it get – did it actually get to a point where people were making – this is the pre-video era, people, where the distributors were making movies specifically for the grindhouse? Or is that another one of those legends that it's just these movies happened to play there, so they got that stigma?
All right. Would you consider The Dirty Dozen a grindhouse movie?
That was Warner Brothers, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That's pretty mainstream.
Well, it don't matter, because it was, because look what The Dirty Dozen spawned. All those Euro knockoffs, A Five from Hell, Inglourious Basterds. So basically, The Dirty Dozen and The Magnificent Seven were the templates for the ensemble cast that became a staple of grindhouse movies. Same with The Wild Bunch. There was not a movie more fucking grindhousey than The Wild Bunch for the sheer level of violence in it. But look what it spawned. I mean, up until this day, you still see Peckinpah's slow motion Dance of Death. It's still there. So that's the huge influence. Some of these films that people would say, well, that's not a grindhouse film. Yeah, it is. All the Clint Eastwood movies were grindhouse movies. Going back, you know, some guys want to remain solvent. I mean, you look at Robert Mitchum. He remained solvent up until he died almost. He was in that Jim Jarmusch movie, Dead Man, before he died. So he always had his finger in the pie. Certain actors, you know, older guys and stuff like that, even John Wayne, he had to rev up the violence in a couple of his movies to stay solvent. And they all wound up in the grindhouses. You know, that's the whole beauty of 42nd Street and places like that. It could be a $25,000 Andy Milligan movie like Blood, and it could be, a big budget thing like The Wild Bunch. It's all encompassing. The whole grindhouse term, you know, encompasses a great many films. It's not going to encompass shit like Bambi or, things like that, or Maltese Falcon or Casablanca or Gone with the Wind. Of course not. Those are, you know, different genres. But as far as the action and the shoot 'em ups, they all fucking ran there, almost all of them. And then it's, you know, spun off lower budgets of, you know, the Italian crime films and, you know, the British spy imports, the spaghetti westerns, of course. And then the big one was the biker films for like, you know, a good 7-8 years, this whole influx of biker films, all different ones. And, you know, the cannibal films, of course, the Nazi exploitation. I mean, just a ton of shit. You know, the blaxploitation, that was another phenomenon that ran about 7-8 years. You know, they all, you know, had great impacts. And pretty much what put them out of business is, you know, mainstream movies, you know, lifted a lot of this stuff because it worked for, you know, these low budget guys. And of course, somebody with a bigger budget would make it look better in a mainstream thing. Look at Shaft. Shaft was a big budget movie.
The Shaft was Warner Brothers again. But yeah, Roger Corman is on record saying that he knew Jaws was the end. He thought that was the end times for him and that he was going to go bankrupt because he said Universal and Paramount have finally figured out my formula, but they can do it bigger, better, faster, and in higher quality than I can. I'm dead.
Yeah, but he wasn't. He's still doing the shit today.
I know, but he saw Jaws as they finally caught on.
Yeah, so, they finally got it. You know, cheap thrills on with a bigger budget. They finally got it.
Well, what a grindhouse, the definition as it's known today in 2015 is that is basically of low budget crap. That's what a grindhouse is thought of. That these movies were, as Tarantino put it, they were literally grinding these things out, and you would get the prints right as they're made. And Tarantino and Rodriguez make it seem like this is just the place where crap went. And I think what I want you to do is dispel that myth, since you were there. They weren't.
No, they weren't. At least Rodriguez admits he wasn't. Tarantino, for some reason, perpetuates this myth that he grew up in a grindhouse. No. Okay, when Night of the Living Dead came out, it was called bottom of the barrel, you know, fucking grade Z dreck. Same with Texas Chainsaw. Same with a bunch of other films. Now look at them today. They're heralded as timeless classics. But the luck of the draw was, okay, they would run in a grindhouse. But when Night of the Living Dead came out, it always, you know, it's running somewhere as we speak. It's never been not playing somewhere since it first came out. Same with Zombie. It's never been not playing somewhere since it first came out. So, you know, as far as stuff that was tailor-made for the grindhouses, there was a lot of low-budget guys out there with limited resources and limited funds. So, and you know, you look at any of these guys' history, like I'm friendly with, you know, Ted Michaels, Gary Kent, you know, Bud Cardos, guys like that. They'll tell you, you know, what they had to go through to make these things. You know, today it's a lot simpler with, you know, flipping up a camera and then throwing a program in that gives it a little grainy look. Oh, that's a grindhouse movie because it has tears and ricks in it and stuff like that. First off, none of that shit was actually made to look that way. That was the brand from shitty projectors and being shuffled back and forth through all these places and, being run 24/7. So that was the end result of the texture of those films. But as far as, you know, just stuff being Dreck, it wasn't Dreck. There's a lot of shit that ran there that were fucking great fucking movies that people, you know, hold in high esteem today. I mean, even Cannibal Holocaust, people, you know, people are going, oh, how horrible this movie was and sadistic. The same with Make Them Die Slowly, Last Cannibal World, a.k.a. Last Survivor, a.k.a. Jungle Holocaust. I mean, it was maybe 8 good cannibal movies if you want to go that route with them. But then you sit down and you see a guy like Eli Roth. Oh, I'm going to, you know, my own vision of whatever. It's not a remake of Cannibal Holocaust. Well, yeah, because it fucking blew. People just don't get a lot of this shit that is a lot of the reason a lot of these films have this mystique and legend about them is because nobody ever fucking did any of this shit before they did it. Now they did it. It made its impact. It was in a certain place in a certain time where it worked. And these films are revered. You can't remake this shit. You can't recapture that ambience or that era. It's done. It's over unless you got a time machine.
You brought up the Italians, and of course you had some Spanish producers and whatnot. Did you guys ever fall for the whole, you know, Vincent Dawn is directing this movie kind of thing? Or did Italian?
We didn't know shit back then. I mean, you know, seriously, what did we know? There was no internet. There was monster magazines and some fanzines. That was about it. There was no fucking internet. There was no way to even, you know, I don't even think Fulci, they used his real name in Zombie. I'm trying to think. I'm not sure.
It's been a long time since I've seen Zombie, yeah. So I don't remember. But I know, like, Bruno Mattei's favorite pseudonym, which I think is a fantastic name, Vincent Dawn. And you had Avidaito Asinaitis. He always packed his movies with American stars to put on the poster and then had an American pseudonym as writer and director to try and fool you. And by the time you were in the movie, you noticed every single member of the crew's name ends in an O or an I. Oh, yeah. Shit.
Well, you know, even going back with the spaghetti westerns, they angelicized the credits on all of them, including Fistful of Dollars. In the beginning, then they stopped. But, you know, you were led to believe the shit was, you know, American. You know, they always try to fake you out. But after you look at it, you know, certain things just, you know, clicked where, okay, this is really too fucking weird to have been shot over here. And especially when guys like Klaus Kinski popped in it, you know, there's no fucking way he was over here.
So did you start picking up on that after a while? Like, hey, the last two Vincent Dawn movies were definitely, you know, dubbed films. I know this is not an American film, or did you not give a shit?
Oh, I knew that going back to Black Sunday. I just didn't give a shit. You know, if it worked for me, it worked for me. You know, when AIP originally brought in Black Sunday and Black Sabbath, they had horrible dubbing. Everything that was brought in the early days had completely horrible dubbing jobs on them. That punk singer, Lena Lovitch, used to overdub horror movies.
We've talked a little bit about the era itself. What about the movies? Did you ever get pissed off at how bad a movie was or whatnot? I mean, speaking of like you just brought up the bad dubbing and whatnot, or did you kind of go, I paid my $3, I'm just going to watch it. I don't care if it's dubbed and this American is clearly a Spanish guy with an Anglo name.
I'd stick it out till the bitter end. I usually did. I mean, there's an old story about me and a bunch of guys having an argument about what movie to see on 42nd Street because last time I picked the movie, it was I Drink Your Blood, I Eat Your Skin, and they wanted to hang me for that one. So I wanted to see Equinox and Master of Terror, which was actually 4D Man retitled down the street, and they wanted to see Hell's Angels 69, but it was playing with Spirits of the Dead. So, okay, fuck it, I'm outvoted. We go in. Hell's Angels 69 runs. Decent biker movie. It's over. They're starting to go leave. I go, where are you going? They go, we're fucking leaving. I go, well, I'm driving. I'm sitting here watching this fucking movie. So I made him sit through this fucking horrible ass movie. I remember it was long, boring, and bad. I haven't seen it lately. I got a copy on the side to watch.
I've got a copy of Spirits of the Dead somewhere. Yeah, I don't remember it being all that good.
No, but that was their punishment. But yeah, if I was in there, I was in there for the duration. What the fuck? And half the time I was so fucked up, it wouldn't have been smart to leave anyway. So.
Well, do you think that what is commonly considered a grindhouse movie today, do you think that is a fair perception that a lot of people try and claim, and this really pisses me off, that The Asylum is making grindhouse movies for a modern audience, and I just want to fucking punch these people in the nuts.
They stopped making grindhouse movies at the end of the 80s because there were no more grindhouses left. All they were doing was they tapped into what became the at-home grindhouse was home video, where basically, because Gary Kent didn't think The Forest ran on 42nd Street, but it did because somebody told me they had seen it there and they're reliable. But some of this stuff may have run, you know, it was the 1 week only deal. Everything was folding up by then. You know, you get toward, you know, when you start going to the late 80s, early 90s, it was all over. Everything was folding up. So maybe something would bang out there 1 week, but there was so much other mainstream crap being made, you know, by Canon and those other places that, you know, there was no market. These guys couldn't get their shit out there. I mean, you know, Ted Michaels, God bless him, he's still making movies up until today, but they're going straight to video. But well, you know, most of these guys, it just got down to the point where there was no way to get these things in. Andy Milligan stayed active for a while till he passed away. But, you know, all this stuff was just, you know, they were shooting it on video and was going right to video. That was it.
Well, I want to talk about video in the next episode. But for this episode, I want to talk, what about the perception of the grindhouse in the movies? Movies like New York Ripper or Shakedown or The Exterminator, movies that use 42nd Street as a backdrop. Do you think they accurately portray it? Because a movie like The Exterminator really portrays 42nd Street as the kind of the old West. You don't go there unless you've got a switchblade and some brass knuckles. Is that an accurate way to describe it?
No, it's the old, you know, and funny because Jeff Lieberman has that attitude too, that it was like completely dangerous. If you were, you know, if you weren't smart, or if you were looking for a problem, you'd find problems. It's like anything else. There were just certain places you didn't go. And to say all grindhouses were, you know, dens of iniquity and shit like that, you know, they were fucked up places, but it wasn't like, you know, you get robbed and murdered when you walked in the fucking door. I mean, you know, the big nights were like Friday and Saturday night. You know, that's when the crowds were over there and shit. You know, people would get pickpocketed. People would get mugged. I mean, you know, if you weren't smart to the whole thing or anything going on over there, yeah, you were a mark. But, you know, to say, you know, I know they shot The Exterminator on 42nd Street. That's actually 42nd Street when Ginty's walking up and down the street.
For Shakedown in 89, Glickenhaus says, he told me when I interviewed him, that is the last movie shot on 42nd Street. He said, literally just off camera, they were already tearing down some of the buildings. So that is your last, that movie is your last glimpse of what 42nd Street looked like pre-gentrification.
Yeah. The New York Ripper, when they were standing outside, I knew where that place was. That was shot in New York. There's been others. Some of the shit that was in Friedrich Cruising, they were shooting them in like the gay porn joints down there where they paid people off. A lot of stuff was shot over there because, you know, what the fuck? I mean, how long would it take you to shoot inside one of those theaters? If you probably paid the management $200 first thing in the morning or on an off hour, they go in and did it. I mean, Even shit we did in Jersey one time, we did an old movie theater. I hooked them up with it. They paid the guy, you know, $100, bang, bang, in and out in an hour. So it ain't that hard to do or far-fetched to do at all.
Well, do you think that all of the grindhouse throwbacks, like the movie Grindhouse, which I generally did enjoy, do you think that's an accurate representation for people who didn't live through the era to go, wow, that's what it was like? Or do you think that is sort of a rose-colored glasses kind of parody of what the grindhouse, what a grindhouse movie was?
Well, first off, the problem with today's audience is, and you know, I liked Rodriguez's part, you know, Planet Terror, because it moved. It was the type of thing that would fly in a grindhouse. But Tarantino's whole Death Proof thing, that would have never flown. That would have been released on a Wednesday and would have been pulled out of there before Friday because it wouldn't draw. And that's what dragged it down. The problem with today's audiences, as opposed to when I was going there, was I could sit through two or three movies, no problem, you know, with the proper, you know, amount of alcohol and weed and stuff like that. I could sit through, you know, a bunch of movies, midnight shows and shit like that. I mean, I saw The Wild Bunch twice in one day because I was just blown away by the fucking thing. And that was almost a, you know, 2.5 hour movie. So I could sit there that long. The trouble with today's audiences, and Barry Windham, one of the professional wrestlers, said it best, they got a video game mentality. Everything's going to be bam, 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 bam. Rodriguez's was, Tarantino's was it. And where the movie theater that I was in, when they came on with those fake trailers, half the people in there, and there wasn't a lot of them to begin with, they got up and left. So that thing.
Yeah, because they didn't understand that it was a double bill and there were two movies.
Yeah. No, because I saw that at a matinee, and it was playing in two different theaters. I walked in the one, there was two people in there. I said, nah, this ain't going to be good. I walked into the other one, I counted 14 people. After Planet Terror went on and they ran those trailers, it might have been 8 people in there. Halfway through the Tarantino film, it was me and one other person there. So, you figure.
What do you think about the acquisition of the term Grindhouse? Now, obviously, you use it in the magazine and in the show Grindhouse Purgatory, but I think you've got more of a right, considering that you were there and you're going off of your memories and your experiences. What about, like, to capitalize on the movie when that came out, every low-budget DVD producer grabbed every old movie they could, and they had the Grindhouse collection, the Grindhouse Essex and all this. Do you think that the word has kind of lost some meaning now?
Oh, yeah, they burned it out. Like, we don't even my last stuff, because we used to call, you know, the porn stuff, you know, Grindhouse things and things like that. We stopped using it on my last 3 or 4 releases. It's just been played out.
That said, then why call the magazine Grindhouse Purgatory?
Because I was there before this shit started anyway.
Well, tell people a little bit about Grindhouse Purgatory before we wrap up this first episode.
I created, there's a backstory to the whole thing. We were going to try to acquire the Screw name and revamp Screw, me and a bunch of other guys. And one of those guys was Andy Kopp, who did the Atrocity Circle and the Mutilation Man, things like that. So we had kept, you know, saying we're going to do this. And then I got a hold of, I think it was Chip Mahoney from Screw, who told me that the name was Poison. Whoever claimed to own it wanted $150,000 for the rights to it, and it was doubtful that he owned it. So I said, well, fuck it. I was going to come up with something else called Screwed, which is too close to the facts. So I forgot about it. Then, unfortunately, we lost Andy. Me and about 3 other guys felt that it might be fitting to do, you know, a one-shot tribute mag in his memory, which became the first issue of Grindhouse Purgatory. And like I said, I was coined not by myself, but by other people as a Grindhouse film historian. So I figured, hey, if that's what people think of me, I may as well use the term. So it was 42nd Street Pete's Grindhouse Purgatory. It was going to be like a one-shot deal. First issue went over and actually made enough money where we could afford to do a second issue. And none of us are getting paid or making any money on this. It's just self-replicating as long as people like it. So Josh contributes to it. I got what I feel is a bunch of writers that are equal to anybody working in the business today. It's free form. It's free spirited. We cover, you know, not only horror, but just about every film genre under the sun. I've done, you know, articles on Lee Van Cleef, Woody Strode. I just wrapped up one on Aldo Sambrell. I've had guys that, you know, people wanted to read Kung Fu. I reached out to a friend of mine who's pretty good with the Kung Fu movies. And I said, dude, you want to take a shot and do something? He did for the last issue. So everybody throws something in and it all works out, because everybody has a different writing style. So it pretty much all meshes. And you can buy them on Amazon. We're up to our 6th issue now. We're going on our 7th issue. I may have an offer on this show down the road. I'll explain that later on, but that's Grindhouse Purgatory.
Make sure you go pick it up, and then we will be back next week to discuss how the Grindhouse era moved into the Video House era.
This has been a 1201 Beyond production. Find it and other great content at 1201beyond.com.